If there's one thing that unites the world's great religions, it's the cost of idleness. It's the enemy of the soul, declared St. Benedict. And the Bible declares it neither satisfies nor nourishes, while Islam declares its harm to our societies, our families, and our inner lives. Work, purposeful work, is important not only for our wallets, but our souls. But, looked at through this prism, the UK workforce is in trouble. We're the only G7 country whose employment rate's not back to pre-pandemic levels. One in five of the adult population isn't working. There are a million 16 to 24-year-olds not in employment, education, or training. In the spring statement, Rachel Reeves pared back access to health-related benefits. 3 million households, the government estimates, will now fall into poverty. What's going on? Well, here to explain is Gavin Kelly. He's a veteran of government, having served in both the No. 10 Strategy Unit and the Treasury as a member of the Council of Economic Advisers. Then he was chief executive of the Resolution Foundation and now the Nuffield Foundation. He's researched, he's developed, and he's thought about policy. And now, welcome, Gavin. It's great to have you here.
Welcome, Will.
Tell me, when we invited you onto the We Society podcast, what did you think about the We Society?
Right. I think the first reaction I had was Will Hutton did a lot of his formative thinking at a time when there was a strong debate about a certain person saying something along the lines of there is no such thing as society, there are individual men and women and families. So it took me back to that in some sort of way, because I guess it is foregrounding the social, the title of your podcast. It is kind of asserting that we're all part of a collective, and wherever, whatever took us on our individual journeys in life, and wherever, whatever trajectory we've been on, we are all rooted in a collective and we are shaped by it in lots of different ways. And I mean that kind of morally, and that we all have, in my view, a strong responsibility to each other as citizens. And so we have to kind of have the concern of others at our heart. But it's also materially, you know, what happens in society comes back to all of us as citizens and indeed as taxpayers. And we'll probably get into some of that today. So I guess the title of it chimed and resonated with me because it is the assertion of the social in all of our lives. And I think that's probably sort of how I think about a lot of social and economic issues and problems. So it feels like a good place to come to.
You've been ploughing this furrow for...
You're going to tell me how old I am.
Well, say a good 30 years. And actually, looking back on it, you know, I mean, some of the things you're going to talk about, you've been talking about for 30 years, and we've hardly moved the dial. How intractable are these problems? And they're almost getting worse.
I mean, I'm not overly optimistic about our social condition as a country right now, and we'll get into that. But I also don't want to be fatalistic at all. I'm deeply opposed to that sort of line of thinking. Things like education, I think, broadly speaking, have improved over the last 30 years. Major caveats to that, which we might get into, but I think overall education across different governments in this country has improved, and that's like a massive plus. But a lot of things have either stagnated or gone significantly backwards. And actually, the theme of today's discussion, inactivity, is kind of almost is the end state of what happens when lots of other things in the system don't work.
Well, let's start. I had these killer numbers in the introduction there. One in five adults kind of inactive, and there's a mental health issue. Economic inactivity means what?
Okay. So I think we should do a bit of unpacking of what economic inactivity is before we then get into like what should we really worry about. Economic inactivity speaks to people who are not currently in employment and are not seeking employment. Okay, so they're not counting as unemployed in our official statistics. If you're unemployed, you're not inactive in the way that the numbers work in this country. So it counts a lot of people because a lot of people are not currently employed or seeking work. For instance, all students count as being economically inactive. All people who retire early or all people who are looking after a loved one count as economically inactive. So the point I would make is that within the total number of well over 9 million people in that total statistic of about 1 in 5 of our working age population, there's some people we should really worry about. a lot of people we should really worry about, but there's also a lot of people we should not worry about. It is a good thing we have lots of people who are staying in education. I would like to see more of them. So we shouldn't worry about that bit of the total number. We should worry about a large chunk of it, which is the rise in inactivity, particularly the rise in inactivity due to ill health, disability, and other kind of health-related issues.
So what is your number, then, of the ones of...
Well...
If it's not 9.5 million, what's the number we should worry about?
The number that I worry about most is the rise in inactivity, which is down to people being long-term sick. So that has been steadily rising. That is a minority of the overall statistic, but we're talking, you know, we're getting on to over 2 million people and rising fast. That is a big worry, okay? And there's another bit of the number we should also worry about, which is young people, particularly 18 to 24s, who are not in education, employment or training. That is a slightly different definition, which I don't think we need to get into, to inactivity. So there's different economists talk about different things, but NEETs are a measure we use for young people. And NEETs are people who are not in employment, education or training. And if you're talking about the young, that's the right way of thinking about it rather than inactivity, because we don't want to be worrying about people who are doing learning 18 to 24, right? And they are inactive.
There's a million of them.
There's basically a million 16 to 24 and 900,000 18 to 24-year-olds who are NEET. And that number is rising significantly. It rose quite fast last year. That is a massive worry. It is also a worry that the proportion of those people who are NEET because of some sort of long-term sickness or disability is rising fast. The majority of young people who are NEET used to be because they were unemployed. There was weak demand in the economy. They couldn't find a job. Now the majority of people who are NEET are inactive, right? But not currently seeking to get into work. And a lot of those people are long-term sick. And that is a massive worry. And related to that, if you look at the future pipeline of what we call NEET, so people who are not yet, haven't left school, but we see a lot of young people, pupils, with the kind of preconditions, if you like, the risk factors that tell us that they're at high risk of going on to become NEET, which tells me that...
Where are they geographically?
Well, I mean, these numbers have gone up across the country, but they are heavily concentrated in areas of economic disadvantage.
It's not just a problem for them. It's a problem for their families. It's a problem for society at large.
It's a massive problem for those individuals. Young people who are not in any employment, education or training for a sustained period, we know quite a lot about what happens to their futures. You know, nothing is predetermined and things can change and policy can help, but it is a massive risk factor in terms of the likelihood of you going on to have sustained periods out of work in the future. Your lifetime earnings are significantly predicted by having a prolonged period of being NEET. So these are massive issues for that individual, the massive issues for the family around that individual. They are massive issues for all of us. You may not be that interested in these. NEETs are interested in you, right? Because it costs the country a fortune over a lifetime in terms of a lost economic opportunity experienced by that young person. So this is something we should be talking about. We're talking about a bit as a country. We should be talking about it so much more. This will be with us for decades to come, the costs of current failure if we don't deal with this properly.
To sort it requires substantive intervention.
It does require substantive intervention. And part of what is going on is that health is deteriorated. Okay, most health surveys tell us that the country has got a bit sicker over time. There's some debate about that, but I think
I've got to pick you up on that. I mean, it's not this kind of inequality in health outcomes. I mean, it's the bottom kind of 2 or 3 deciles of the adult population who suffer these health problems. So it's part of being a NEET is actually being unhealthy.
If we're talking specifically about NEETs, then the biggest thing that's happened in terms of health has been the very sharp rise in mental health problems for young people. But the biggest single thing that's changed in terms of health in the period when these numbers have gone up has been the mental health of our young people. That's the biggest single factor, which when you look at all the charts, that jumps out as being kind of really different.
Now, do we know much about that. Well, that's, so I mean, that's, do we know when they say mental health, that's a range of things?
Range of different conditions. Lot generally kind of covered by anxiety and depression, which has many, you know, many different levels of severity. But so there's a number of different conditions and you can break them down and so on. But we've seen a general rise across the board in young people reporting significant mental health conditions. Now, that I think is real. There's a debate about how real that is.
Listeners to this will be thinking two things. You know, what a number. That's great. That's just that. That's a problem. And then they'll be thinking, you know, how real is it? Shouldn't they square their shoulders and get on with it like I did when I was 30 years ago, you know, and all that?
No, I hear a lot of that. I think there is something real about the numbers. I think there is a higher likelihood of people reporting an underlying condition now compared to like 15, 20 years ago. I think part of it is a greater willingness to talk about things, which is a good thing. And I think it's also the case that some people say that there's kind of been some change in definitions about what would count as having a significant mental health condition. So there are different things going on. I think the research isn't good enough in this question. But in a way, I sort of feel like we could sort of spend years talking about that. We have a large body of young people who have got a poor state of mental health. Whether or not that's because they've got much worse, I think some of people mental health has got much worse, or it's because they're more willing to talk about it. It is a real problem today that we are living with, which is going to affect us for many years to come. I think we have to respond to it. So I think that's just one important thing to say.
I was reflecting whether there's a kind of purpose crisis going on, whether there's a, you know, as a national community, you know, we're not sure what we're doing, where we're going as a country. And then in some of the kind of deprived, disadvantaged parts of the country, it becomes even more obvious that actually, you know, they live in a country adrift. It's one of the reasons why, you know, there's such political fragmentation and support for the major parties falling away. And that, you know, you're kind of 17, 18, 19, living in a disadvantaged part of Britain, and you're thinking, you know, well,
the austerity decade was very, very tough for the poorest local communities in terms of what happened to the nature of their local area, the provision of local services and so on. So I think a whole range of social and economic factors has intensified the problems experienced by the more disadvantaged parts of our country. But I do think it's important to say this is about more than that, because it is also, I think, the case that other things in our society have changed in the period in which mental health has deteriorated for a substantial minority of our young people. The trends started COVID made everything we were going to talk about today, the pandemic made worse in lots of different ways, and that is a big, big factor. But the trends in terms of mental health clearly started well before COVID. They started roughly at the beginning of the 2010s. And there's a big debate about exactly what drove that. As many people will know, there's a very live debate about the role of social media in that, which I think sometimes can be simplistic and crass, but I don't think there's much doubt that it's had some role in increasing mental health challenges. Whether we can lay all the blame at that door, I think it's
a big
question.
So what can we do? I've got to really kind of get the kind of Kelly recipe for action.
So it's a good thing, first of all, there is a government talking about an 18 to 21 year old guarantee. And much, you know, that's a positive. And that's not been fully fleshed out yet. So we don't know exactly what that means. I think the scale of intervention needed to address the issue we're talking about in terms of the condition of a large minority of our young people, you know, getting on for 1 in 6 of our young people are currently needs in this country, the scale of intervention that we need to put that right, I think needs to be of an order of magnitude larger than is being currently discussed. What does that mean? I think it means we're going to need a generation of employment support programs to get young people closer to the labour market, the young people that we're talking about closer to the labour market. They're not suddenly going to be walking in to really, really good jobs. It's going to take a process of engagement in the world of work. That's going to need employers to play ball with that. And that is going to take a lot of work by the government. I think we need to completely transform how we think about things like apprenticeships for young people. It is a complete disgrace that the number of young people undertaking apprenticeships has fallen so sharply over the last decade and more. You know, we are positively redistributing economic opportunity in the form of things like apprenticeship from the young people who need it most towards older workers. And it just is mind-boggling when you look at the condition of the country and you kind of think that is what we have been doing. We have been limiting opportunity for the people who most need it. And this has been going on for quite some time, and redistributing the opportunity for older workers who want to get... there's nothing wrong. I mean, it's a good thing that older workers want to get advanced apprenticeships. But looking at the state of our nation today, that is not the number one priority. And we have to be much more aggressive in prioritisation for young people to get a foot in the door of our labour market. This is the young people who have not gone down the academic trap. They're not part of the roughly half of the young cohort who are going to go on to university. And we just have not taken that seriously. And people have said this for an awful long time, but we're going in the wrong direction.
This season of The We Society is brought to you in association with the Nuffield Foundation. For more than 80 years, the Nuffield Foundation has funded research and innovations that sit at the heart of some of society's biggest challenges. Evidence has the power to change lives, whether it's improving educational outcomes, reducing inequality, or understanding how society is changing. The Nuffield Foundation's work helps policymakers and practitioners tackle complex problems. To find out more about the Foundation and its research centres, visit nuffieldfoundation.org. It's one of the most disquieting and upsetting elements of class in Britain, The sons and daughters of the middle class have the university route. It's uncapped. If they want to borrow the money, they can go to university. There's no limit to the number of places. But if you're a NEET, kind of the availability of apprentices, the availability of training, the availability of courses at FE colleges is capped.
It's capped. Yeah. We don't have what's called a demand-led system.
Yeah.
As you rightly say. So we ration the places. And we haven't been increasing the amounts per pupil, if you like, in FE, in the same way that we have for pupils in the school system for quite a long time. So, there's many elements to that. So there's an educational bit in terms of FE education. There's pre-16. There's, some of the kids we're talking about have become increasingly disengaged from school before they're 16. As I say, overall educational standards have been rising. We actually are performed quite well compared to many of our peers in terms of the international test results at age 15. But a subset of the kids who are most at risk of ending up in this category are disengaging well before that. And I think there's a really big question about how we engage children at age 14 and 15 to actually keep them engaged. Yep. And we haven't taken that seriously as a country, I don't think. That costs money. You need alternative forms of provision. They might be wanting to spend some time out of the classroom, out of school. That needs organisation. That has not been a priority. So I think that is an issue. The point I would sort of make in terms of really kind of getting to grips with how we're going to try and respond to the size of the challenge we've got is that this feels different to you previous efforts where we've had to kind of deal with a version of NEETs in previous generations. So I was around in the late 90s. I was around at the global financial crisis when there was a big demand shock and we were really worried about opportunities for young people at that time. And we created something called the Future Jobs Fund, which was an employment support program. We subsidised employers.
Which did very well, by the way.
Which was a good program. And I think we can learn from that. That was a successful program. I think we can learn and things like that, but I think it's going to have to be different because this is not a kind of short-term acute crisis. This is a chronic crisis. This is young people who have got a health issue, many of them, who are going to need different types of support as well as alongside employment opportunities. So we're going to have to sort of tailor a package for this generation, which is going to feel different to the packages that governments have come up with in the past. And I think, therefore, we haven't got something on the shelf for this. We've got bits and pieces of it we can learn from, but we're going to have to try at scale and at pace employment support programs, particularly in disadvantaged areas, that both get people into the world of work, even for a temporary period, alongside giving those people the emotional support, the health support that they need for that to feel viable.
Who are their champions?
Yeah, no, we're not talking nearly enough about it. We really aren't. And the thing I would say is, well, first of all, because, and this is a kind of post COVID issue to some degree, but because of what's happened to things like, you know, the rise of absenteeism in school and the kind of very sharp rise in things like special education needs and disability amongst pupils, I worry that we can already see the next rise, if you like, in NEETs in terms of the cohort who are currently, you know, 13, 14, 15 in school. So we really need to be trying to prevent that through intervening in school to stop, if you like, to weaken the pipeline of this problem. But we also need to kind of accept that we're going to have to put in place, you know, programs which are going to support people through their 20s. We've seen this really, you know, quite sharp rise in people who are reaching 25, having never been employed at any stage by the time they're 25. And that, if you haven't worked at all by the time you're 25, that is a real worry in terms of your future prospects. So literally the most expensive thing we could do as a country is to pretend this isn't a big issue, because we will be paying the price for this collectively for decades to come if we fall short now.
But we haven't discussed the people older than 24. I mean, it's not exactly kind of, you know, peaches and cream there either.
No, well, we have lots of challenges. I mean, I think it's also important to take a step back in a way and tell ourselves, in terms of overall employment levels as an economy, we have generally been quite high compared to a lot of our European peers. So we are quite a high employment society in this country, and that is a good thing. And that has generally risen over time. So we've got something to, you know, we've got stuff to work with there. But what is revealing is that for one of the highest employment societies in Europe, we are one of the lowest when it comes to the employment rates of people with significant health or disabilities. And that just really stands out when you look at this. High employment society, but actually relative, one of the lowest performers when it comes to people with significant health impairments or disability. Now, lots of people with health impairments and disabilities do work, so let's be absolutely clear about that. But we perform poorly, and there's a real gap. And I think that tells us, so that's a flashing kind of red light, if you like, on your screen, saying something is not right in our country on that front. And we, you know, I mean, there's many different issues there, but we are very, very bad at preventing people leaving our workforce. So we spend a lot of money. We have been spending increasingly large sums of money on benefits for people who have got significant health conditions. Health-related benefit spending has really accelerated. It's gone up by about 50% over the last 5 years. It's expected to go up by about 100% over a decade. That is a large increase. And that is where almost all of the current public debate is about that sort of, you know, spending on benefits for people with significant health problems. We should be spending most of our time talking about how do we as a country make it possible for you to stay in work and lead a decent working life whilst you have significant health conditions. And that requires significant change from employers. It also requires changes in our social security system, in my view. It requires changes about how we think about retirement, because many people are going to be working older for longer. And we can get into what some of those changes might be. But it's a really large-scale shift in multiple areas of our public life that we are just not focusing on. And I think if we want to age better as a society, we're going to have to talk about this issue too. So it's a young people crisis here and now, but there's also just a long-term, slower kind of burn issue of how do we make it a better country to work in and get older whilst you have health conditions? Because we know, the Health Foundation's done lots of work with this, that there's about 3.7 million people that we expect to be working age with significant health conditions by the time we get to 2040. That's a very large increase on today.
Now, let's just unpack this. Is this, do we need a better public health because the NHS to kind of reorientate itself around, yep, you know, prevention? Is it about the structure of welfare benefits, and that actually kind of, because they have been, I mean, there are those who argue this, I mean, and there is data which supports it, that actually inevitably the people kind of move towards the more generous benefits. There's been a bit of that. There's been, you know, the phenomena that you describe for young people also applying to people kind of as they grow older, that actually there's a genuine health crisis, mental health crisis. I mean, where now, Unpack all that for us.
Yeah. Well, let's just take a few different aspects of this. So one thing is that we have...
And also think about Chancellor Rachel Rees, the controversial spring statement.
Yeah.
Health-related welfare benefit cuts.
Yeah. We need to be talking much more about how to stop the future pipeline of people reaching the point where those benefits come into play. That's what I want to prioritise. We have, in this country, if you think about the kind of how the flow of people who get to that position, we have, first of all, the quality of work in this country is an issue. So we have a lot of people, you know, work is generally good for you in terms of how you feel about yourself. But for a large minority of people, work can be part of the problem. Work can, you know, kind of make worse.
It's not good work.
It's not good work. It can make worse an underlying health condition, and sometimes it can create one. So there is part of this debate is about better quality work. And that is something that the government of today is talking about in different ways. So that is important. So that is one part of this debate. Lots of people will inevitably get significant health conditions who are working. And a large focus needs to be on the kind of flow of people who could stay in work if there was an adjustment made in their working lives and in their workplaces, but that doesn't happen. So we need to be much more sensitive to that, and we have to create incentives for employers to worry about that. I think it is striking in this country how, for many employers, and there are honourable exceptions to this, they're just sort of not that worried. They haven't got that much skin in the game. There's a high churn workforce. You're not going to spend a lot of money keeping your workers healthy, fit, because it will be cheaper for you to replace them with someone else. If you look at, say, the Netherlands, the Dutch system, the level of sick pay is dramatically higher, and the employer is on the hook for paying about 70% of typical wages in sick pay for 2 years to a member of their workforce if they become ill. That is a high-powered incentive.
This is flexi-security.
One aspect of flexi-security.
Which is also true in Denmark as well.
And Denmark has something similar to this too. Yeah. So there's a number of North European countries who take kind of prevention really seriously, and one aspect of that is having employers who have strong incentives to worry about keeping their workforce healthy, because they will face a financial consequence if they don't. Now, we have literally nothing like that in this country. We're starting miles back. Sick pay is kind of incredibly low in this country, and it's very hard to survive on it. Now, there are some employers who go massively above and beyond and have good schemes in place, and there's lots for us to learn from the best practice in this country. Centrica is a great employer when it comes to this issue.
Centrica?
Yeah, really good. And they have a really impressive scheme of kind of workplace support, case management for keeping their workforce fit and healthy. And the results have been really impressive. And there's other companies too. So we have to be careful and be led by the evidence here. But generally, we have really low levels of statutory sick pay and relatively weak incentives for employers to worry about keeping their workforce fit and healthy. And I think the state has not been, you know, at all proactive in this. It should be a really important part of government policy to think, how do we support a high-quality occupational health system? We also, though, I think, have an issue within our benefit system. And I would just say two things. One is, it is right that the basic level of benefit in this country, roughly £100 a week on the standard allowance of universal credit, is something that not many people could survive on. There has been a very binary high-stakes test, if you like, to get access to health-related benefits, something called universal credit health, which would pay you roughly double the amount that the basic amount would be. Okay, so there's a kind of big step up. Still a relatively modest amount of money to live on, let's be clear, but it's a big step up. And that creates a strong incentive for people who, not to make up things, but these are people who do have health conditions. But if you are unwell, long-term sick, you would much rather be on the benefit, which at a higher level, where you don't face stringent conditionality, than the one which you basically can't survive on. So the structure of our benefit system adds to this problem, in my view, as well as the low level of sick pay. I'll try and do a simple version of this. The way that universal credit works does not incentivize people to undertake part-time work. And most of the people who we are talking about who've got significant health issues, the idea of a full-time job, and this is a generalization, but a lot of survey evidence tells us that in terms of desired working life, it is a kind of part-time job, 2 days, 2.5 days, sometimes 3 days a week, which is where people might be willing to try something. And our current social security system does not incentivize that at all, really. And that is a massive problem. Now, that is fixable, but it is not where we are today. And we should be talking about that, because those sorts of changes can give people a place, both in terms of working life, where they get some support from the state and some adjustments made by their employer, to some, which may make work feel viable for them in a way where currently it does not. And a lot of those people will end up seeking to get on to, currently, to health-related benefits, which are, you know, which costs us a lot of money as a country. So we need to be much more ambitious about prevention.
If you had to put your finger on one thing which the government has done right, what would it be? Or governments, I should say.
Well, let me answer that, and let me draw a connection between that and what I think one of the challenges is in terms of us being a society where people can stay in work as they grow older, with many people having health conditions and us having to adjust to that. And when I look back at kind of the years of my career, if you like, one of the things that has got better in this country, very significantly better, even though there's much further to go, is if you look at employment of parents, particularly mothers, overwhelmingly mothers, over the last 30 years or so. And we have seen a transformation in maternal employment rates over that period of time. And we've seen a transformation in the very broadly defined kind of policy space around it. It wasn't that there was one announcement one day on one policy. We had multiple changes and improvements in kind of legislation concerning kind of maternity pay and returning to work rights. We had a childcare strategy, a 10-year strategy in the first place in the late 90s, which has been built on repeatedly by different governments. So our childcare system is completely unrecognisable to anyone who can remember the mid to late 1990s. And we've seen social change in terms of just how we think about the issue. Like, you know, the 1990s feels like a different country in terms of many employers' assumptions about the role of women post-childcare in their workforce. So there's been a whole social shift in our country on that issue. I think, and the analogy is by no means perfect, it's a different set of issues, but I think we need something on the same scale over a generation, and it will take a generation, when it comes to us working better and longer as we age as a society, with many more people having health conditions and disability able to lead fulfilling lives in work before they reach the state pension age. And we are going to, that isn't going to be one policy announcement. It's going to be changes in how employers think about this workforce, very significant changes. It's going to be changes in how we think about sick pay. It's going to be changes in universal credit to enable that. It's going to be, require changes in the rules about when you take your personal pension and can you draw on your personal pension while you're getting some universal credit. It's going to change. It's going to require multiple long-term policy change, which needs to be kind of coherent and brought together. I feel like that is a long-term project which would make us age more gracefully, if you like, as a country, which we are not currently on a course to do.
Gosh, well, what a discussion. Thank you, Gavin. I mean, you have a big agenda, Mr. Kelly. Big agenda. And the very best of luck.
Thank you, Will. A big agenda for all of us, I think. But thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Nuffield Foundation and Leverhulme Trust. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.